Hello, everyone, and welcome to Chapter 4 of Livrum of the DM. I am DM Mike.
I am DM Ed.
I am DM Saul.
And we're doing a special occurrence tonight where we're recording back-to-back episodes. We're going to skip the section about where we talk about what we've been doing because you just heard it in the last episode. So we're going to move right on to listener questions. Our first question comes from Zach Nafane Warden. He says, okay, I tend to vacillate a little on this. High magic versus low magic settings and adventures. Mostly, I tend to prefer more of the low magic end of things. It makes magical items and spells so much more treasured. I also tend to find high magic and can devalue other classes unless a heavy emphasis is put on the magic items. I have a low magic world that used to be a high magic world. A war of wizards decimated much of the land about 500 years ago in my game world. People became suspicious of mages and basically started attacking them on sight and driving them out. Magic items were found, destroyed, hidden away. So there's not a lot of magic readily found. There's no magic shops. There's no places to buy scrolls or potions unless you're buying healing potions from priests. So I tend to drift towards the low magic with the option of finding these items if you know where to look.
I have run both high and low magic, and I don't like either of them. High magic, I find devalues or even outright kills that all that magic usually should inspire, and it makes a lot of class abilities less cool and less valuable once you achieve them, if you have a magic item that does something better or something equivalent already. I find low magic can sometimes tip the balance too far in one direction or another, or you exhaust your magic too quickly and then your party is left with not much to work with other than just the skin on their teeth. So I like to keep scrolls and potions fairly readily available, as they are very limited use, and they provide great potential, but without a consistency or without a constant. And then I like to make enchanted items common enough that you can see them on like a nobleman or a legendary adventurer from time to time, but they require a lot of work to still acquire.
I tend to go with the lower magic just because I think having it all over the place and readily available to anybody who has the coin for it is just, I guess you could say overkill or just over empowering everyone. So then anyone has a magic item and nobody's special. But I also like to make it so that magic items are more commonly treasure that you find when you're on an adventure or dungeon diving, rather than, oh, well, hey, look, we can just go to any one of the 6 magic shops in town and we can just get whatever the hell we could afford.
I spent a lot of time running in Forgotten Realms, and I think that was the biggest thing that drew me away from it, was it was such a high magic realm that finding a +3 sword was kind of like, ho-hum, throw it over your shoulder because I already have something better.
I haven't really run into that issue, but I guess it depends on the DM as well. It's not just necessarily the setting is like that, so that's how things are. The way I have done it a couple of times, even though I'm typically low magic, is there was a couple circumstances where I was pulling the adventure into a scenario where they would need to have at least a +1 weapon, or else they weren't even going to be able to kill or harm what they're going to be going against. So I had a magic shop just kind of magically appear in a small town where it would not normally be, and they carried just ordinary +1 items, some items that are made of silver and happen to be +1, as well as a few of the minor healing potions, not anything like extra healing or potions of that nature, but some of the more simplistic things that you could find.
I kind of went the route to accommodate that type of situation where you're saying you needed a +1 or +2 weapon to hit. I have magical metals in my world. Anything forged from mithril will be a +1 weapon. Anything forged from adamantium is going to be a +2 weapon. So instead of having to worry about a wizard enchanting an item to make it more powerful, characters can either find or have crafted items that are made out of these two metals that will give them the bonuses that the other world's versions of the +1, +2 weapons would be. I guess on a side note, I also believe that treasure should be rolled up before an encounter. Because my world is a low magic world, any creature that finds one of these items would typically be using it. And I know that a lot of games that I've played in, the DM will actually roll treasure on the spot after the battle's over. And I find that if there was a +2 short sword, wouldn't the kobold or the goblin or orc that we just fought be using it? So I will roll up magic items ahead of time, and I will actually let those creatures use those items if at all possible. If they find a wand of magic missiles, they would have no idea what the command word is, so they might not use that. But as far as armor and weapons, I will make sure that those are being used by anybody who could possibly use them.
See, for me, I don't pre-roll up the treasure before, because most of the games I run are just on a forum. So that's where I use like a treasure generator program that will tell me this is what is in the area. And they're not necessarily on whatever was just defeated. In one case, it was actually inside the stomach of the monster they killed. So they wouldn't necessarily be using a plus one sword if they consumed the person that had it.
And that's fair. You've got to base it on the logic of the situation. But if you do find you're rolling up treasure for a group of orcs and they happen to have a plus one sword, I still think that should be assigned to one of the characters, because why would they leave this really nice, pretty, well-made sword aside while they're using their mediocre weapon?
Yeah, and if that is the case with a forum game, I would say, yeah, that orc actually was using it, because all they're seeing is what I say the result of the attack is. If they hit or missed or not, they could still have had a magic item and just rolled really badly.
Well, that is one way to look at it, but when you're describing what they're using, you can point out that, hey, he's using a really nice looking short sword.
See, that's where I just lack in the detail. I don't tell them, oh, by the way, that lead orc over there has got a sword made out of gold, and, you know, it's got an aura of lightness around it.
I think that pretty much is where we differ, because I do like to give good descriptions, and if I do have a magic item to assign to a particular monster, I will kind of hint at it before the combat starts. Nothing more fun than watching them face off against a kobold who has really nice boots, who is now zipping across the field with a haste belt.
I try not to do it like that, just because then the whole party is focused on that one, and all the other ones are now attacking them because they're too busy trying to get the one that has the magic item.
Good strategy for you as a DM. You can have all the rest of them gang up on somebody who's focusing on getting that magic item.
Priorities, man.
All right, well, let's talk about the next question.
All right, Zach Naveen sends us another question asking about house rules. Stats and stat rolling. Recently, I have been thinking about how to encourage players to work with some lower stats from time to time, some character weaknesses. Thoughts on this idea? Instead of giving XP bonuses for high prime requisites, what if I give XP bonuses for low stats, sort of a reflection of a character working to overcome deficiencies?
I'm actually a big fan of this idea. It kind of represents the you learn more from failure than you do success mentality. I'm not really sure how meticulous you would want to get with it, but you could pretty easily set different percentile bonuses for progressively lower stats. Similar to how if you reach 16, you get an additional 5%. You could potentially say maybe you have an 8, so you get an additional 3%. It's not bad, but it's definitely below average. And then you get your normal prime requisite 5% at around 6. And then if you go all the way down to the minimum of 4 or 3, maybe you give a bonus 10% or something. I'm not really sure how the math would work out. I've not tested this, but I do like the idea, and I might try using it at some point just to get a feel for it.
Do you think this would inspire more of your players to play characters with lower stats?
A couple of them it definitely would. Others, I still see prizing the higher stats and just playing more patiently, but some of them, yeah, would definitely enjoy this.
I think it would probably be the same thing as what Saul is saying. You know, I like it. I like the idea, and I even encourage you to use it. But I can still see that there's going to be a group of players that is up for the challenge, and others are just going to be like, no, I really don't care. I think I'm just going to go with the one that's going to be better at hitting things and doing things better than the guy that's got a low IQ and all that.
I think you kind of have to gauge your players. Some players may embrace this. Some players may shy away from it, just like you said. For me, I think this is a fun idea. What I would do instead, though, if I'm trying to show my players that there are other ways to play a character, I would probably have a one-shot session designed just around this. Roll up a bunch of characters, have them draw the character names out of a hat, and this is the player that you're playing for the day. They have very basic to low stats, maybe one good stat. Also, it might give them the ability to play a character that's out of their normal scope of characters. I've had characters in the past that played only fighters. One would play only a ranger or a paladin. He would never play a cleric or a mage or a rogue. So by having him draw the character out of a hat, it would inspire him to, hey, this is how a rogue works, and I can learn new concepts that might help me with the other characters. Plus, I'm playing a character with lower stats, so I can see where some of the abilities can be fun if I'm playing a low stat and how I can work around them in a role-playing situation. Once again, I think it depends on the players themselves as to whether or not they're even going to be open to an idea like this.
And I can also see where some players, you might have to give them further incentive to want to run with a lower stat character, or at least a character with some stats that are lower. Maybe having to give them a little extra starting money so they have more money for equipment or something like that. An extra point they can throw into a different stat, something like that might just entice them a little bit more.
I tried this one time with a group many, many years ago, probably when I was a teenager, and I said, hey guys, for one night, we're going to roll up different characters. We're going to play these more average characters, and I'll give you a bonus to your regular characters in our campaign if we do this for the night. I had one guy who said, absolutely not. He would not do this. He didn't even draw the name out of the hat. He basically packed up his stuff, walked out of the house, and I didn't hear from him for about 6 months because he was that mad about having to play a character that did not have good stats.
I can say I've not run into that situation before, but I would believe that for some people that I've seen.
As would I. I would believe that myself.
It's just funny how some players are so attached to the mechanics of the game that they can't see outside that and get to a role-playing aspect of it.
That's kind of why my whole point in gaming is I'm willing to do whatever the players are going to do to have fun and enjoy the game.
So I think we're all encouraging him to try something different, whether you try your giving him a bonus for low stats or maybe even just one night letting them play a different character with lower to medium stats, just to let them see that, hey, a party can still exist and do well even if they don't have 16s, 17s, and 18s.
Yes, that is what I would say.
I'd like to thank Zach Naveen for his questions. Please keep them coming. Now I'd like to move on to a question from David Wagner. He's asking about learning spells. When your character attains a new level, he may or may not receive new spells. This is up to your DM. How do you handle this?
I require that wizards find spells. I let them learn from either scrolls or spellbooks that they find. I do require that they try to recreate the spell in their own spellbook before they can cast it.
How about if there's another spellcaster in the group that has a spell they want to learn? Would you allow them to learn it from them?
Yeah, I would allow them to do that if they wanted to.
The circumstances are that, you know, it's not an illusionist trying to learn a spell that they can't know.
Well, I think even if they're learning from another player, they'd still have to roll the skills to see if whether they even knew the spell or not. And then if they did, they'd be able to copy it into their spell book.
Yeah, that's how some DMs run it. Others I've seen will allow you to copy it from the other player's spell book without even, you know, having to roll for it. It's just, oh yeah, sure, you can share your spell book with that guy and this guy can share their spell book with you and you can copy each other's spells.
Well, by definition, wizards are very jealous of their spell books, so I'm not sure any player should be willing without some sort of compensation to let somebody copy a spell out of their spell book.
Be like, yeah, you can copy my spells if you give me about another 300 coins.
Or exchange spells or something along those lines. But I still think that they should have to learn the spell to know if they can even copy it. Because half of what they're doing is copying down the phrasing and the wording that they need to cast the spell, along with knowing a list of all the spell components. Since magic is its own special language in my world, if they don't know what they're writing down, they can't really write it.
And I would even go so far as if you happen to be in a civilized area, they can even go somewhere and pay to learn a spell that they want to know from another higher up wizard or even like an archmage or something like that.
Because I use the skills and powers, I do allow the wizards to take the ability to gain a free spell every level. What this means to me is that they've been spending all of their downtime, whether it's at camp at night or the time in town, they're doing research of a spell that they already know. Maybe they've seen their mentor cast it. Maybe they've seen another party member cast it, or they've seen a monster cast it. But they're working through the ability to learn that spell. So when they gain a level, they're like, aha, I finally have it.
That's actually kind of the other part of what I would have gone with as well. They could have already learned the spell and wrote down all of the major components and all that they need for it from when they were apprenticing, and now they just are able to actually cast it.
Basically, they learn it as they're going along, but if they do not have this ability, I require them to find the spell from some other source. whether it's finding a spell book or maybe finding a spell carved into the wall of a ruined tower that a wizard used to own, or maybe even from a scroll vendor. Wizards can cast spells from a scroll, but they can also take those spells and copy them into their spell book. The spell disappears off the scroll, but at least they now have the ability to memorize and cast that spell. Once again, it boils down to whether or not they know how to cast that spell based on their intelligence roll.
Yeah, I don't really use that part where you have to roll to learn or you fail and you can't ever use the spell.
Well, I try to keep the limits of the intelligence in place. I make them follow the level limits. So they may start off with 4 first level spells, but if they only have a 17 intelligence, they can only learn X amount of spells based on that intelligence roll. Their spellbook will eventually max out on each level of spells based on what their intelligence is.
Yeah, well, this is actually pretty good because the next question he asks is still spell-related. It's about casting spells, and do you require people to use spell components? Do you enforce this, or is it an optional rule?
This is an area where I fall short on. I really want to enforce this rule, and I want the players to keep track of it, but I rarely do a follow-up to make sure the character is keeping track of how many spells they've used and how many of the consumable spell components have been used. I want to. I think it's a great rule. If we're making archers keep track of their arrows and we're making them keep track of how much food they've used and torches, why not spell components? So yes, I want to use this rule, and I need to do a better job of enforcing it.
I do not require spell components for the first 1 through 3 level spells. I do this because of my rules for priest magic, where priests get the entirety of their spell levels when they reach it. Once you have second level priest spells as a priest, you just have all of them from all of the spheres that you have. In order to balance that with how I run mages' acquisition of spells, is I say that for the first few levels, they don't need to worry about their spell components, especially since most of those require very minor basic components as it is. A lot of them you can just kind of find while foraging, or you can pick up while in town for not too much cost. So I really don't enforce it for those, but once you hit the 4th or 5th level spells, then I start enforcing it, because that's when the disparity between the priest and mage spells gets greater and the mage spells start getting much stronger. And also that's when the actual cost of the component starts to escalate.
Yeah, I don't enforce the spell components rule, but I do allow them to purchase spell components, or in most cases, I actually just give them for free. Like Saul is saying, you can find most of the spell components without even having to step foot into a store. You can just find it anywhere in everyday places, foraging, out in the woods, in a cave, whatever. I mean, to try and make people have to go out and purchase every time they run out of spell components would be kind of ridiculous, in my opinion.
But you make them purchase food and arrows when they fire them, so why not spell components?
Okay, so some spell components are pieces of your own hair. I'm going to make you purchase that? I don't think so. Or you need a little gob of bat guano? Yeah.
Well, there's not bats everywhere, so it would make sense that, especially in the area of the world you're in, you might not counter any bats, so where would you acquire the bat guano?
You had a backpack full of it. There you go.
I still think I like the idea of the rule, and I'd like to follow it a little bit more. Another thing I'd like to note is that unless the spell says that the component is consumed in the spell, I usually let them keep reusing a spell component. So in the case of sand for casting a sleep spell, the sand drifts through their fingers and they cast the spell and then they kind of throw the sand towards the opponent. There's still going to be a bunch of sand left over. They may have to reacquire some sand after a few castings, but for the most part, those are reusable spell components.
Well, with that, would you be like some DMs where, well, I'm making you track your arrows and your sling bullets and your stones and your bolts from the crossbows, but then you get a chance to roll to see how many of those you're able to recover afterwards? Would you do the same thing with spell component use? I threw sand. Well, how much of the sand am I able to brush back up?
I would absolutely do that. If I were keeping track of spell components as well as I should, as well as I do for arrows and crossbow bolts and other things, I would definitely want to do this as well. So it is something I fail on. It is something that I should do better at.
I guess you could also say from my standpoint, it's just something I don't want to track.
And some DMs don't. I mean, I can understand how the bookkeeping can get a little tedious. So if you just want to say you fired 12 arrows, you gathered all of them back at the end of combat, that works too. Well, thank you, Dave, for that question. I hope that helps you out a little bit. we're going to move on now to pages of the DM, where we are going to start talking about traps. What do we use for traps? How do we deploy traps? And what are good traps?
Well, I think since Saul was so eager in the last episode, he gets to start out.
Oh boy. I use traps pretty sparingly. I don't deploy them in all of my dungeons, and they're not around every corner of each dungeon that I have. I try to make sure that when I do use them, they're not terribly obvious and that they're placed in such a way that they're going to be effective, I guess. I try to make sure that they have detrimental effect because of circumstance or because I don't use them often enough that players might forget that they exist on occasion, especially if they don't have a thief constantly prowling around for them.
I guess you have to look at why are there traps in the dungeon anyway. I try to gauge all of my traps in a logical manner. Who created the trap and why? If it's a lawful good or any other lawful or good combination of alignment, I think that their job is more to deter people from trying to gather their stuff than it is to basically kill them. In some cases, you enter into a dungeon that was devised by a lawful evil or chaotic evil, a lich or whatnot. His traps are going to be there to kill. So I like to base my traps on what dungeon they're in and whether or not it's supposed to deter or kill them.
Which is a good point. The way I usually put them into a dungeon, or not even in necessarily a dungeon, in a scenario that the characters are going to come across, is mostly it's a security measure. Like, oh, there's a dart trap in that chest. Well, that's because I don't want people taking my stuff. I generally don't have overly lethal traps in place.
I can't say the same. In my last gaming session, which was about 4 weeks ago, I incorporated a trap that actually ended up killing one of the characters, Saul's character, actually. And it was a big rolling boulder coming down a hall. He didn't get out of the way in time, and he got squished.
And he became a Saul pancake.
But my armor survived, so that was cool.
Man, that's got to be some really strong armor.
It was magical. It was mithril, I believe. It was plus one.
All right, so Mike, how do you explain that one? The guy is flattened and squished, popped like a pimple, but his armor is whole and intact and somebody else can wear it now.
The boulder rolled over him, hit his feet, kind of got saved by the armor his torso did, and then his head got squished.
So really, he's just a torso.
With maybe a few appendages.
So the next person has to clean out his torso.
Glad I wasn't there to do that.
That's one of those scenes you just skip to the next scene where the next guy is wearing the armor already.
Well, the point of the trap was the people who were activating the trap did not want anybody coming down the hallway. Didn't matter who it was, they were trying to keep them out. So the trap was a very large, deadly trap. They were trying to say, hey, don't come down here.
Yeah, that'll do it, yeah. I mean, I've had players face a necromancer and his traps weren't that bad, but he did get them stuck several times in scenarios where they didn't know how in the heck they were going to get out because both the way forward and behind them were blocked off and they were entirely trapped underground in a section of tunnel where there was nowhere to go.
And sometimes that's what you want traps to do. You want to trap the party without actually killing them. The boulder trap could have been avoided, possibly. But, you know, if you don't have a rogue doing their active searches and you don't have anybody keeping an eye open, the traps are going to sometimes be deadly.
They don't always have to be deadly, though. I've even used just simplistic snares. You know, there's bait out here. You go to grab it and, oops, I didn't notice that there was a snare there. It was well disguised and covered up. It blended right in with the surroundings. But now I'm hanging from a tree by my leg.
And that's more of a deterrent trap from my point of view. So for me, traps are going to be very situational. I've used pit traps to trap players from being able to get out and go anywhere. I've had pit traps with spikes. I've had pressure plates that fire darts and arrows. I've had magical traps spring off and do damage to the party when they step on a pressure plate or enter a certain area. It just depends on where they're at and how that trap could be employed by the person creating it. So that's a little bit about our opinions of traps. Let's move on to the opposite end of things, and let's talk about the find and remove trap skill. Do you roll for the player or let your player roll their own rolls? And how do you rule a critical failure or pass of these checks?
I typically let the players roll for themselves, apply whatever the result is. If they succeeded, then I'll tell them you did or you didn't see it. If they didn't succeed, well, they didn't see a trap there. And then they'll find out if they were right if they opened the door.
I myself have adapted the practice of rolling for the characters. This is one of the thief skills that by rolling myself, I can keep them on their toes. When I make the roll and I tell them that they did not find a trap, they have to determine whether or not they actually did not find a trap and it's clear, or maybe there's a trap and they just didn't find it.
I let the players roll for them, but like the DM on my Roll 20 game on Sunday nights, he will let us roll for our checks. And even if it's a passing roll, he'll still be like, yeah, you didn't find anything and there really wasn't a trap there. Or you fail, but you think it's clear. That's kind of the same way I run with it as well. And it sounds like Saul does too.
Well, the rules state that a 96 to 100, if it's rolled, it's a trigger of the trap. Do you guys follow that rule?
If I determine that there is a trap there, absolutely. But if I didn't actually place a trap there, there's no trap to trigger, so nothing happens.
Right, yeah. The trap would have to be in place in order for that rule to even take effect. But I do follow that rule myself, that if a 96 to 100 is rolled, if there is a trap, they've triggered it, and whatever the result is what happens.
Yes, that's exactly how I do it. Like I said, if it's a poison dart trap on a chest and they rolled in that range, yeah, they're getting hit with a poison dart and they're going to suffer whatever effects.
Do you have any critical failures or passes on your assault?
I usually don't, no. I usually just have either yes or no with this.
All right, so that's how we handle find and remove traps. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email us at librumofthedm@gmail.com or feel free to post a comment on our Google community page, which is librumofthedm, or leave a comment on our Podomatic website. Moving on to the next section, we're going to talk about mimics. Ed, you want to talk about their stats and ecology and whatnot?
Yes, 250 of the Monster Manual. Their frequency is rare. They're a solitary organization. Activity cycle is any. They're carnivorous, which is kind of funny for something that can pretend it's like a chest. Usually they're in a subterranean is the climate or terrain. There's apparently two different types. There's a common mimic and a killer mimic. Number appearing is 1. Armor class is 7. Movement is 3. Could you imagine being chased by a chest with teeth that moves 3? Hit dice, 7 to 8, it looks like. Or killer is 9, 10. Thaco, 13, 11 on killer. Number of attacks, they only get 1. Their attack is a smash attack. It does 3 to 12 damage. Special attack is a glue, which if I remember correctly, even though I've got the book in front of me, they sort of treat like a glue substance. Their special defense is camouflage. Their size is large. Generally, XP value, if there are 7 hit dice, that's 975 experience for a common mimic. For the killer, it's 2,000 for a 9 hit die HP mimic. If it's an 8 hit die, it's 1,400 for a common, and for a 10 hit die, it's 3,000 of the killer mimic.
I really enjoy the mimic. I don't use it that often, but I find that it's a great monster to throw against unsuspecting parties. They can alter their form to appear as anything they want to lure their victims to be their dinner. I have had them take on the forms of chests, tables, and even a coat rack once. That had a magical cloak hanging from the coat rack to entice the party even more. The cast detect magic, saw the cloak, went to grab it, and they started getting attacked. They surprised their victims on a -4 penalty. If they score, they get to get 1 free attack, and then with initiative is rolled. They might even get 2 attacks before the party even has a chance to do anything. Being that they have a surface of glue, the party gets 1 shot. You swing your weapon, it sticks to the mimic, so you've done your damage, but now you've got to grab another weapon in order to continue attacking them. I think that they have a very creative and endless use. You can throw them anywhere. Wizards are known to summon them to protect their valuables. But since they actually have a method of reproduction, I don't see why they wouldn't reproduce and then maybe move on to their own place to find their own food and whatnot. They're even known to give off a rotting meat scent so they can attract small animals to their lair so they can eat them.
Well, an interesting thing with their glue, too, is that after it dies, it takes at least 5 rounds for it to even wear off so that you can get anything that's stuck to it free. But while it's alive, it's immune to acid attacks, and it's unaffected by molds, green slime, or various puddings.
It does say, too, that they can neutralize their poison at any time, so if the weapon that's stuck to them is hindering them, they could just release it and then start attacking the party freely.
Yeah, it also says that you can use alcohol to weaken the glue, but it takes 3 rounds, and what are you going to walk around with? A keg and just pour it on there?
You'd have to know what you're going up against to even have the alcohol handy.
Or just be a really good dwarf.
There is that. Saul, have you ever used a mimic?
I've used a couple mimics in the past. Probably my favorite one was there was a wizard's mansion that the party was adventuring through, and they were looking for some treasure that they'd been hired to find. And when they found the treasure chamber off in the corner, there was a chest that had magical chains wrapped around it. And the chains is what enticed them to really investigate the chest. And they worked at the chains, they broke them off, they got rid of the magic. And as soon as they broke them off, strongest fighter was just swallowed whole. They're definitely one of my favorite monsters for purposes of DM entertainment.
That is definitely what I would classify a mimic under. It's pure enjoyment for the DM.
It reminds me of something I read online. Somebody said, a party walks into the bar and the bartender says, why do you guys have your weapons out? The party responds, mimics. The bartender laughs, the party laughs, the table dies. It was a good time.
Well, you know, and the funny thing is you could even have it disguised as a door frame. Who's going to suspect the door frame?
Yeah, the party walks through a dungeon, walks through an archway, and the archway attacks them. I like it.
I don't remember which one they added it in, but there was a supplement for second edition that they added greater mimics that were significantly larger and could take up entire rooms. And they had magical abilities and could cast illusions, so an older mimic would cast the illusions of people inside of this room that they turn themselves into. So they'd just like affix to the side of a house and become a part of it. So you'd walk in and they'd just devour an entire party at once.
I've never used one of them, but I have read about them. They are definitely a detriment to a party.
Well, the funny thing is a common mimic is neutral in alignment, but the killer is neutral evil.
So the common one is just out to feed itself, and the killer one is out to do damage on purpose?
That's what I would take that for, based on just the brief information they have. And other than that, the only real difference is the size. Common one occupies about 150 cubic feet, and a killer one occupies 200 cubic feet.
Intelligence, too. The killer mimic is significantly less intelligent than the common one.
Which seems backwards to me. You'd think that the one that's lawful evil and planning to kill a party would be more intelligent because it could set up the traps and do what it needed to do to draw the party in. So that's our take on mimics. If you've used mimics in your game, let us know how you've done so. If you'd like to know more about them, feel free to ask us in the Google community page or our email. Moving on to our next section, we're going to go to the pages of the spellcasters, and we'd like to talk about a couple trap spells. One coming from the mage and priest is the fire trap spell. It's found on page 273 of the priest spell compendium, is a level 2 priest spell. And the mage spell, which is 4th level, is found on pages 365 and 366 of the wizard spell compendium, volume 2.
They're both also in the player's handbook. The revised version, it's on page 201 for mages and page 260 for clerics.
So what does the spell description say, Ed?
The spell description says that it's a spell that can be used on closable items and lasts only until discharged. So it's permanent, but only until it's been set off. The item that it's going to be set on has to be touched by the caster, and the damage of the spell is 1d4 plus 1 per level of the caster. A failed disarm will set it off immediately. It's not affected by a knock spell. A failed dispel also sets off the trap, resulting in an effect of an explosion 5-foot radius center of the spell. Caster of the spell can use the item without causing the spell to discharge. The spell caster can also attune it to other players in their party so that they can also use it without setting off the trap.
So how could you see your party using this, or have they used it?
I've never seen anyone use this. It's a fairly inexpensive spell. The component for a mage is only sulfur or saltpeter. You don't even need both. You just need one or the other. For higher level mages and adventurers, once you start getting a home and you build a stronghold, you maybe make a camp somewhere to keep your stuff at. It's a fairly inexpensive and rather potently effective way of killing or scaring off thieves that might be prowling about while you're off adventuring. Once you get to maybe 8th level, you can kill an orc or a barbarian just without even rolling damage, just from the bonuses. So if you have a homestead somewhere and it's raided, they decide to open your chest, you could just clear your little room of some greedy bandits looking to steal your stuff. Come home, just don't stick it next to anything flammable, and your stuff is okay.
Yeah, it's nice that it has a 5-foot radius, so a group of level 1 rogues gather around a chest to try to open it would all take 1d4 plus that A damage you're talking about, and that's pretty much going to knock them unconscious or kill them outright.
Yeah, well, it depends again on the level of the caster. If it's a level 2 priest that's casting it, it's just going to be 1d4 plus 2. If it's a 4th level mage, then it's going to be 1d4 plus 4, so that would be more damage.
Well, a wizard has to be level 7 to even cast a spell, so they'd be doing at least 8 points of damage, maybe 11.
It would definitely be 7th level, right? Is that the same level it was in the book you found it in?
Yes, it is. It's a 4th level spell, and they need to be level 7 to cast it.
At least for a priest, it would be a little bit easier to get their hands on and be able to use.
Party could use this as a trap for monsters in a dungeon, too. They could wander off, leave something behind that's trapped, and a monster walks by, says, "What is this?" opens it up, and they suffer a little bit of damage.
Yeah, that's actually what I was thinking. If you're in a hostile environment and you're forced to rest, and you know there's enemies around, this would be the spell I would use to try and help protect your area that you're going to rest in. So when something comes in through the door, bam.
Yeah, and the spell specifically says you can cast it on a door, so if you want to get some quiet time to rest and recuperate, you could ward them off and cast it on the door. They open it up, it explodes, the party can jump into action, kill the monsters, close the door, and maybe cast it again.
Yeah, it says it's limited to only items that can be closed, so you could even cast it on a book if you really wanted to be mean to somebody.
Go to the library. Oh, what happened to you? I decided to read a book on pyromancy, and now I have no hair.
And my face got blown off.
So that's some fun ways to use the fire trap spell. Let's move on now to the Leoman's Trap. I find this spell to be a lot of fun. You can find it in the Wizard Spell Compendium on page 502, volume 2. It's a nice little trick that would stop a lot of thieves. Ed, would you like to read the spell description for us?
Well, you also missed that it's in the Player's Handbook. Revised copy, it's on page 185.
Yeah, I have to apologize for that. I spend all my time in the Wizard Spell Compendium because it's got all of the spells, so that's usually where I default to find my spells.
And since I don't have that book, I go with the Player's Handbook first. So yes, this is basically a fake trap. It's an illusion. It's a second level mage spell. The whole idea is that they can use it as a means of protection to deter people from trying to steal their stuff. So, hey, don't go into my backpack and try and steal my crap. I'm a mage. I've put Leoman's Trap on there. 100% detected. You find a trap and you can't disarm it. But it's because there's not really a trap. And the duration on this spell is permanent.
So anytime a thief runs across this, they're going to look. They're going to say, hey, I'm 100% sure that there's a trap on this and I have no way to get rid of it.
Exactly. It's a major mage security measure.
I could also see a wizard using this in conjunction with maybe an explosive runes or something along those lines. So they detect it. Yes, it's definitely a trap. They open it and they actually take damage from it.
Now combine this with the spell we just spoke about.
So you've got Leoman's Trap and you've got Fire Trap on it. So they're going to take damage that way as well.
Give them a fair warning before you destroy their entire party.
Yeah. You're like a level 17 mage and you've put it out there.
So that's our take on Leoman's Trap. If you have any questions, let us know. Moving on to our next section is our footnote section. In the Dragon Magazine, issue number 254, pages 66 to 76, there is a wonderful article about designing pit traps for your dungeons. A lot of these pit traps can be very deadly and dangerous to a party if they're not discovered. There's a few in there that may just trap to a party or minimal damage. But the article is a really good read if you're looking for new ways to use pit traps.
Yeah, I would say personally as myself, I wouldn't want to use a lot of the pit traps in this article, but some of them sound like they could be quite hilarious practical jokes.
Now, these aren't traps that I would use all the time, but I think the thing out of the article that I would use most is what you can find at the bottom of the pit trap. You're going to find maybe some skeletons with some remaining items. you might actually find some monsters. There's a few good charts in here that allow you to determine not just that, oh, you fell into a trap and you hit some spikes and you climb out, but hey, there might be something down here. Maybe there's a gelatinous cube waiting to catch you when you fall to the bottom.
Or like the one where you fall through one and then the lid rotates and then you fall onto another lid and it rotates and dumps you into another pit. Or the reverse gravity one where you don't fall downwards, you fall upwards.
There's a couple spells that have that same effect, that you try to walk into an area and it slams you into the ceiling, slams you down to the floor, slams you back into the ceiling, and then you drop to the ground.
Yeah, I think that was in there. They had one trap set up like that where you fall up, then down, and then up, and then back down. And the second time down, there's like a block of metal or stone that comes with you.
There's a couple of the traps in there that are like that. There's a few that just say there is no saving throw against this, and you basically just die.
Yeah, and there's even some where it will trap you below in another pit with a stone that blocks the actual passage above that you were trying to go through, so you're just trapped in this one little chamber short on air.
Yeah, you get like 20 minutes for every 20 cubic feet or something like that. I think my favorite out of this was the lumberjack pit. You know the pit's there. You have this very narrow log to cross, and the party has to make a bunch of dexterity checks as they're crossing this to make sure they don't fall down below. They have a couple of various options for that. You can add grease, so it's even harder for them to climb over. They have a rolling one where you have to make an even better dexterity check if you want to cross this without falling into the pit below.
Yeah, that's almost like the guys that walk on logs while it spins in the water.
They have one that's trapped, too, that it's fine on both ends, but when you get to the middle, it cracks, it falls, and you fall into whatever's below. You could make that just a regular pit. You could make that water. You could make it acid. You could make it spikes. All kinds of things that you can do with these pit traps.
Oh, well, don't forget about the one where part of the log is actually an illusion and not really there.
I was getting to it.
The best thing I can say about this is that it is very creative and provides a really good guideline for making some traps.
But if you're not looking for pit traps, you can find other sources. In our next section, we're going to talk about citations. Flying Buffalo's Grimtooth Traps. I do not personally own a copy of these, but from everything I've read, everybody always refers back to these traps if you want to find unique and fun ways to poke at your party.
Yeah, and there's actually 6, if I remember correctly, different copies that you can get of their traps. The first one is 54 or 56 pages of just different traps. They've got them broken down by chapters, so the first chapter is about room traps, the second one is corridor traps, and then door traps, and then you got items and artifacts, where it's actually items you would use to bait people into a trap, but the bait itself is actually the trap. And the last chapter they talk about in this first one is called Things, where it's mostly made up of things that are like peepholes in a wall where you trick the player into thinking they're seeing into another room or around into another area or seeing a monster, and it's actually a trap. When they press a little bit harder on the wall to see better through the peepholes, it shoots a spike out into their eye or something of that like.
And you thought these pit traps were dangerous.
Oh yes, but these Grimtooth traps are quite interesting as well.
So if you're looking for traps, I would check out the Grimtooth Traps and also maybe this Dragon Magazine article. There's a few other Dragon Magazine articles that cover traps, but I think these two are the most fun that I could find. Moving on to our next section, we want to talk about Boots of Featherweight. These are enchanted items that are beneficial to a rogue. I found them on page 195 of the Encyclopedia Magica Volume 1. These boots have no effect until the wearer steps on a trap or other device triggered by the weight. At that time, the boot instantly reduces the wearer's weight to nearly zero, negating the device. The wearer is not aware of any change in weight unless the area is windy. If so, the wearer is blown about light as a feather for one round.
So even as a magic item, it's kind of a practical joke if you're in a windy area.
And kind of a detriment to a party, because if your rogue is wearing these and they move off ahead, they don't realize that they've just crossed over a trap they didn't find, and the rest of the party follows behind, and boom, they've activated the trap.
This could be an amazing item in dungeon delving if you had a party with 2 rogues, or maybe a ranger and a rogue, because you could give one the boots, have them move silently and sneak ahead perfectly safely while the other rogue stays behind and pokes around looking for traps with the rest of the party. And then if the rogue up ahead that's scouting sees something, he can just rush back and report, maybe help find some traps along the way if it's safe, or if there's some more to be done, he can just continue moving onward. If you are outside in like the plains or on a mountainscape, then I don't see these being very helpful at all. You'd lose your rogue. He'd fall down the mountain 10,000 feet.
Yeah, but I could see where they could be useful if you don't happen to have somebody that can disarm traps. If all you've got is a priest-class character that can find traps by using their spell, find traps, they can't disarm it. They can just say, oh, by the way, guys, there's a big trap right there, but we can't cross it unless you have the boots. And then we'll all have to share the boots and hope we have the same shoe size.
They are magic, though, so they could adjust to fit your feet if needed be.
Tell that to the half-giant in the group.
Some of those boots will adjust up to giant size, so they could be used by them.
Hopefully nobody's got foot odor problems.
I still see them as both a benefit and a curse, because if you're traveling with a group and the rogue doesn't detect a trap and walks over it, never triggering it, the rest of the group is going to suffer from it. I think these would be more useful for a solo adventure rogue who is traveling by himself, and he can move along, and if he doesn't detect a trap, he just keeps moving and doesn't actually trigger it. Of course, this is only for pressure-related traps, so a tripwire or a area entrance trap trigger would still affect the rogue in question.
Yeah, so you could have a pit trap might not actually trigger it, right? Because it's not necessarily pressure-plated, but it is weight-related, so that would probably affect the boots, right? They would stop them falling through.
That is correct.
But if you're on, say, that, lumberjack pit, that's a different story, isn't it?
Oh yeah, the boots would not help them at all because they know the trap's there and they're trying to walk across this bridge to get to the other side. So the boots don't help them at all. They'd want to switch out to boots of spider climbing or something along those lines.
And actually, as a solo adventure, there are some modules out there that are called, what is it, the Thief's Challenge? That would come in handy for some of that.
Absolutely. So there's a new magic item that you can introduce to your party if you want to give them a little bit of fun. Moving on to our next section, we're going to go to the Librum of the Player. What we'd like to talk about here is the non-weapon proficiencies that we feel could benefit a group in their aid in detecting traps. Maybe setting snares, rope use, engineering. What non-weapon proficiencies do you find that are helpful?
I've never had anyone use the engineering, but I have had them use rope use and set snares for some creative, either reverse engineering of the set snares in order to try removing certain traps, or for rope use, trying to trigger a trap off from a distance, pulling something onto it, pushing something over, or even just as a group heaving a pressure plate out of place and hopefully disarming it that way.
I would say from my experience, it's more using those to actually build and design and then put a trap in place, not necessarily to disarm them or try and overcome them. Although I can see where that would be useful, as you're saying, Saul.
I can see if somebody said they took engineering and their main focus was building traps for whomever in town, that I would give them a bonus to using this as a way of also detecting traps. They have a basic idea of how traps work, where traps might be placed. So maybe if they have the main class of a rogue, but engineering as a skill, they might get a bonus to finding the traps because they're more aware of them.
That makes sense, yeah.
Another non-weapon proficiency that was introduced in the Thieves' Handbook was observation. This is their ability to observe and study things and learn from them. I think with this non-weapon proficiency, I might also give them the ability to get a little bit of a bonus when trying to find and remove traps as well.
And then there's also the perception stat if you use it.
I didn't use perception as a means of finding traps. It was more of a way of seeing things that were out of place or out of ordinary. They might perceive the king wearing a ring that he wasn't wearing before to maybe clue them in onto something. But I never actually used it for a rogue to find or move traps, but I can see where that could also be beneficial.
And actually in the newer editions, at least in 5th edition, I know of perception actually is kind of like you can spot things out of the ordinary, but you also tend to find traps using perception checks.
Not being as fluent in 5th edition as you guys, I have to take your word on that.
At least that's what the DM of the 5th edition game I'm currently in has been using it for.
When I played it, we were allowed to do that if we also had the knowledge of traps, so the disarming traps ability or the kit for it, then we could make perception checks, and that's how we would find them.
Well, and in my experience, it also might be because I'm playing a thief class character in 5th edition using perception.
That would probably be it, if it was run similarly to how my game was run.
So if you have non-weapon proficiencies that you use to help thieves out, let us know. Next, we'd like to discuss the priest class spell Find Traps. This is found on page 270 of the Priest Spell Compendium, Volume 1. Ed will tell us where it's found in the player's handbook.
Fire Trap, which is on page 204 of the unrevised original Player's Handbook for 2nd Edition. And it is a fun little 2nd level spell, because it allows the priest class character to actually find traps. It takes one turn to cast, so this is definitely not something to use in a combat situation, since a turn is much longer than a round.
Actually, the casting time is a 5, the duration is 3 turns.
Yes, 3 turns, my bad. The range is 30 yards, though, so that helps. 3 turns, casting time 5, area of effect a 10-foot path. You can at least find where traps are, so you know where to avoid them. You can't remove them like a thief can, but if you don't happen to have a thief, it's pretty close to the next best thing you can do.
And it falls under the divination school, so that helps almost every single priest gain that spell, since divination is a more common minor or major sphere.
Yeah, so that way it doesn't even matter if you're a specialty one or not.
So the caster gets to learn the general nature of the trap, whether it's magical or mechanical, but not the exact effects nor how to disarm it.
Right, because you would think you would need a whole separate spell for disarm traps as a cleric who is not a thief.
And I think it was wise of them not to include that, because it would eliminate the need for a rogue if you had the priest or even the mage be able to cast spells to disarm and find traps.
Well, that's the fun thing, is I didn't find that there is a mage spell.
There is not. It is cleric only.
So this would just actually go back to a prior episode where we were talking about how clerics aren't just for healing. There's proof. If you have a cleric in your party, but you don't have a thief, you can use them to find traps, and not just as bait.
Yeah, if the rogue goes down, or the rogue has missed 3 traps in a row, and the party's a little wary of them, they can just say, hey, cleric, go ahead and cast a spell. So once you find it, you can point it out to the rogue, and then maybe he can disarm it.
Unless he's just got the worst rolls ever.
Which is why he missed the first 3 times. So it's a very useful spell. I recommend every priest keep it in the back of their minds that they may need to use it. Moving on, I would like to talk about some tools that are useful for a thief to find and maybe remove some traps. These tools are lockpicks and a magnifying glass. Lockpicks are not just for picking locks. They also have tools in there to help the rogue push aside a trigger for a trap so they can unlock the door or the chest without actually triggering the trap.
Yes, and actually, according to the Complete Thief's Handbook, you would actually need lockpicks in order to work on removing a trap that would be in, like, say, a lock or a smaller location or locking type of device. And if you use improvised lockpicks, you would actually suffer a negative 30% penalty to trap checks.
That is one rule that I tend to enforce, is the requirement for lockpicks for many of the thief skills. I find it makes sense and helps explain how exactly the thief is capable of doing what he's doing.
Well, yeah, how else are you going to explain how he disarmed a trap that was inside of, like, a chest locking mechanism?
You just cast enlarge on the lock, and the lock just falls off.
So how did the thief cast enlarge if you didn't have a mage in the group?
Because thieves are really good at hiding the fact that they're wizards.
Okay.
So the other tool is the magnifying glass. This, I allow the rogue to gain a 5% chance to finding traps and even picking locks, because they can see things a lot better.
And I can see that where that would be making sense, but I've never heard of anyone else ever really doing that.
I've never done that, but I might need to implement that, because I do like the idea.
It's an item available in the Thieves Handbook, and it's kind of one of those optional items, and a DM doesn't have to allow it, but I just think it makes sense that if a rogue has a magnifying glass, why wouldn't they use it and be able to see things better and get a bonus?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think it's in miscellaneous equipment as well in the Player's Handbook. Costs 100 gold pieces to get one, though. I think for that price, I would offer more than 5% bonus.
Well, by the time they reach level 2 or 3, they're going to have expendable cash where they could buy this. So I don't think it's that unrealistic to charge 100 gold pieces to give a 5% bonus.
Yeah, and you're a thief, so you could just steal it from a scribe somewhere.
I stole it from the rich mage.
To this list of items, I'm going to add miscellaneous. I once had a party not too long ago that didn't have a rogue. Nobody wanted to play the rogue in the party, and they didn't really communicate very well, so everybody was everything but. And they went to one dungeon, stepped on some traps, got screwed over. Later, they found a shop owner and decided that they were going to go with a 10-foot pole. I was a little confused, and I thought that they weren't serious, but they decided to take the oldest gag in D&D, got a 10-foot pole. They got one reinforced with iron until it was +3. That was their plan, was they were going to use a +3 10-foot pole reinforced with iron so that it would have a bonus to its durability checks if it was caught in spikes or crushed by something. And then they would use that for a little while until they got another player to join and play as a thief.
How did we miss the obvious? We didn't put the 10-foot pole on the list.
They also had a bag of holding, which they stored it in. That way they didn't have to lug it around. If you have yourselves a bag of holding, get a 10-foot pole and bring it to a blacksmith.
It's always fun watching parties come up with creative ways to detect and work around traps.
Yeah. That would be hilarious, though, if they didn't have the bag of holding and they have to explain why they have a 10-foot pole. Well, this is our trap checker.
That would definitely be amusing. I would enjoy that interaction.
Especially if they role-played it and gave the pole a name.
So I think that concludes our episode on traps. If you have any questions or comments or suggestions for us, you can leave them at our email at librumofthedm@gmail.com. Visit our Google community page. Our next episode is going to cover illusions. We're going to talk about illusions from all aspects, so tune in for that. This is DM Mike saying have a great night and enjoy the rest of your week. And until next time.
This is DM Ed. Don't forget your 10-foot pole.
This is DM Sol. Have a good one.